Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Spiritual Hollywood Hour. I am Kate Romero, the host of Spiritual Hollywood. And as usual, I can't say another word until I give thanks and gratitude to BBS Radio Network's Don Newsome, Douglas Newsome, and Seth Hendrick over at BBS Radio for providing us with this excellent platform to raise consciousness. I have tonight, speaking of raising consciousness, an excellent guest that you're going to find to be very intriguing. It is Georgia Foster. She is a visionary hypnotherapist in from London, and she's very, very well known and respected in the UK. She has what's known as the Foster Technique, which is a form of hypnosis that I have not seen done before. And as a person who co-created quantum hypnotherapy, I thought I'd seen it all. But Georgia Foster has a really wonderful technique that's very, very effective. And her website is www.georgiafoster.com. That's georgiafoster.com. So be sure to pull up her website there. Tonight's topic is, why do people overeat, overdrink, overstress, and overthink? So with that in mind, I'm going to give you just a bit of Georgia's background. This woman walks her talk, very, very authentic person, and practices what she teaches. Georgia struggled with food and self-esteem issues for over 16 years, which led her to search to find a way to break free from these negative emotional states. Using her own form of voice dialogue and hypnotherapy, she has literally changed her life. Her techniques are unique and highly effective. She is highly sought after therapist and media contributor and has appeared extensively in the media within the UK and Australia and is now launching herself in the US. Georgia was born in Melbourne, Australia. She has lived in London since 1994, where she qualified with distinction as a clinical hypnotherapist with the London College of Clinical Hypnosis. She previously studied a particular form of Jungian psychology known as voice dialogue in California with internationally acclaimed founders Hal and Sidra Stone. As a leading practicing therapist, she uniquely interweaves voice dialogue with her hypnosis with amazing life-changing, life-enhancing success. She has lectured, oh, that's our little protege, he's very hairy, excuse him. She has lectured on hypnotherapy and has trained students all over the United Kingdom. Georgia Foster's books, each with a self-hypnosis CD program, includes The Weightless Mind, The Drinkless Mind, and The Four Secrets of Amazing Sex, launching in June 2009, is the Relieving Writer's Block's ebook, Hypno Download, and The Stressless Mind later in the year, which I now have a copy in my hand, so it's available now. Georgia presents one-day workshops on each of her book topics, and her work has been widely featured in the UK media, including The Times, Body and Soul, Daily Mail, Guardian Independent, Metro Daily Express, Psychologies, Cosmopolitan. There's so much and so many, it's hard to say them all. Now and New, Scarlet, Slimming Magazine, Bella and Zest, and she has been a frequent guest on radio and TV. And our public relations company has Georgia going up to San Francisco tomorrow to be a guest on View from the Bay, which is an ABC affiliate and widely watched, that is on just after General Hospital and just before Oprah Winfrey. So that should be a really great experience for Georgia. Without further ado, let me bring on Georgia Foster for you. Hey, Georgia.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
I'm great. I'm a little winded from saying all that, but but it needed to be done. You know, and there's just so much that a person cannot get in that brief little snippet I gave about who I find you to be, and I've done a lot of research on all of your whole body of work and all the books and heard all the CDs, and there's much, much more than I've mentioned. I'd like for you to tell our listeners, if you would, what was it that led you exactly, that defining moment that led you to the work you're doing today? What was it that you just heard the voice and just went for it?
Well, in my 20s, I had an emotional breakdown. It wasn't sort of certified as the sense of went to the doctor, but I'd really lost a sense of self. I don't think I actually even knew who I was. And Well, food was my coping strategy, and I was a binge eater. And when I hit puberty, I realized that how you looked was really important, and I felt I didn't kind of fit into that look. And not being disrespectful towards my best friend, but she was a very famous model in Australia, and she had Rod Stewart chasing her, and it was always in the history of my life, I just never felt that I was good enough in any respect. So in my 20s, I kind of had to take stock, and I realized I went to a health farm for the mind that I had to basically go into therapy for 2 weeks. And when I was there for 2 weeks, I realized that actually, even though I felt I was different and there was something wrong with me, I sat with people who all felt the same way. And I kept thinking, well, you're rich, you're good-looking, you're slim, you're successful. You shouldn't belong here. You don't belong here. I do. I'm the one that's the crazy person. And I realized when I left there that I was not alone, and that was one of the greatest gifts I gave to myself. And even though I hadn't resolved my problems, I realized that I had to, that this was the only way forward for me, that food was not the answer, that I had to find a way to like myself. So my mother's a therapist, and I was in Melbourne, my home city, and there was this fabulous book sitting on the couch, and one of those synchronistic moments, I picked up this book, and it's written by Dr. Helen Sidra-Stone, who Jungian psychologist, and I started reading this book, and I just thought I was reading about myself, and I was just completely blown away. So my mum suggested, you know, why don't you go and train with them? Why don't you just find out, you know, if this is what you really, really want to do? And that was the beginning of my journey. I went to California and I trained with them and their facilitators. And then I went to London because my grandmother's British, so I went there and I could work there legally at the time. And I just kind of, I was exploring. At the time, my boyfriend's best friend's wife was actually studying hypnotherapy for giving birth, and I thought, well, that sounds interesting. And then I looked at all the different colleges in London, and then I found this one I thought sounded the best. And I just never looked back. It was like falling in love. I just knew that this was my path. It was just the penny dropped. And with the teaching in California, I decided that I had a very unique approach to therapy, and I started hypnotizing myself and making myself my own recordings, and then just, you know, noticing the changes in myself, and then obviously as I was building a client base, noticing it with my clients too, with great success.
That's wonderful. And so you were your own experiment that was a successful one.
Yeah, I mean, when I look back, I see very clearly now that it was my life path, without a doubt. And the twists and turns, if I look at, I'm 43 now, when I look at, you know, the twists and turns from when I was 28 and the journey I've taken, it's been not just a professional journey, obviously, it's been a personal journey of seeing myself as a great person, of actually saying, actually, Georgia, I am a good person. I am a really nice person. And that was the fundamental change for me when I realized that I had an opportunity to really genuinely deeply like myself, then I knew that my world could blossom, and that's exactly what did happen.
Right. So actually, overeating, binge eating, and you know whatever else you were doing at that time before you got your epiphany was a symptom, not the cause.
Absolutely. I didn't realize it at the time, but looking back, and obviously with the training that I have now, my clients is that, you know, I say to people, you know, is that if you're not hungry, you're eating for another reason. You're not eating because your stomach's saying, oh, I want some food. Your stomach has nothing to do with it. And it's really what's going on with your unconscious mind, which manages all of the emotional habits. So any sense of vulnerability will override if there's no hunger. And that's the power of the mind. And when I realized that I was hungry for love, I was hungry to feel confident, I was hungry to belong, and I because I felt so separate and different, that food was my solace, that was the way for me to escape.
Right, and it is for so many people today. You know, there's an epidemic of childhood obesity present, and what do you think is going on with the children? Do you think they're just following a pattern and lifestyle of their parents and their role models, or do you think that there might be a deeper issue, or you think that because the children aren't doing the grocery shop and they just simply eat what they're being given?
I think it's a combination. I mean, as a hypnotherapist, if somebody, for example, comes to see me with a fear of spiders and they've never met a spider in their life, I say, you know, obviously it doesn't matter where it comes from, but usually there's somebody who has been a strong influence in their emotional learning capacity as a child. Say, for example, a parent, a mother or father, or an older sister or brother who's had a fear of spiders. And we actually inherit other people's anxieties. So if you grew up in an environment where your mother or your father had food issues or was permanently on a diet or ate food for the reasons that I ate food, there's a very high chance that you will have emotionally inherited that particular trait as well. So it's no surprise that obesity does come in families.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So it's you know, for someone to gain awareness around that, whatever it is that's causing the family to be obese or unhealthy or not be conscious of just how they're eating and what they're eating, what would you say to parents who really would like to break that cycle and create a new generation of health in their ancestry?
Well, I think parents have to take a responsibility to look at what's triggering them, because children learn from their parents how to deal with life. And if their coping strategy is food, then that person, that individual parent, needs to take stock and say, you know what, I've got to break this. I've got to take responsibility for this. And one of the ways is to build confidence, to build self-esteem, because anybody who may be listening now who has suffered or is suffering with weight issues or food issues, is underpinning all of this is a lack of self-worth.
Right.
And that needs to be, that foundation needs to be built in order for change to be.
I agree with you 100%. So basically the basis of your work and the core of your work is to help others learn what you learned about yourself, is that you're valuable, you're worthy, you're lovable, you're complete, and you're whole, just as you are and just as you are not, and you have full acceptance of yourself. And is that what your work is leading people to glean for themselves, to get for themselves?
Yeah. I think a lot of people who struggle with their weight can be quite in a negative way, strong perfectionists. So their expectations of where they should be is usually, I think, is just too much. And so when somebody, and there are two reasons why people may yo-yo diet or gain weight, lose weight or whatever, and one of them is that when the mind, if food is the way to make that person feel emotionally safe, even for a millisecond, then what will happen is that mind will build a library, references of food, and then all of a sudden, when somebody wants to lose weight, they'll go on this really strict regime of, you know, exercising like crazy, eating, you know, the way that the particular diet program suggests in some magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they fall off the wagon, then they give themselves a really hard time, and then they start to do the opposite. So the perfectionist trait is on the spectrum of all or nothing.
Right.
And this then in itself creates lots of physical anxiety, lots of fear, and that person may end up being, you know, either, as I said, on a diet or losing weight. And so they never have that balance. And that's part of the problem with it, having a perfectionist personality, is that the truth is no one's perfect, as in the sense of, you know, sometimes we might gain a bit of weight if we go on a holiday, whatever. It's not about trying to keep that perfect weight. I believe it's about a little bit of balance. And I think that this is the problem, is that the media and all the frenzy about how we're meant to look hasn't helped the situation either. In particular, I believe with women, you know, more so. Men are affected, of course. We know that anorexia is becoming more common amongst men as well.
Mm.
But it's really about trying to work out how to break those states. And with the hypnosis, are you happy for me to talk about that now? Or
Yes, I'm happy for you to express yourself fully in whatever direction you'd like to go. Right. I have some general questions, and you're already answering them before I ask. So before you touch on that, however, just because we're speaking about food right now and how there's an epidemic of that, there are eating disorders that come with a lot of shame and guilt that a person will withhold getting help for those for literally decades because of the shame and guilt. Like anorexia is a pretty obvious one. The least obvious eating disorder is bulimia. Mm. So is the psychosis different for why a person would choose bulimia over just compulsive overeating or anorexia, or are they pretty much all a nervous tick?
Yeah, they're both a nervous tick, but they actually have very different personality traits. And this is what's amazing about, you know, what certain people create certain habits. A perfectionist probably would be more on the side of an anorexic or would keep their weight at a certain, you know, minimum level, whereas a bulimic is more a pleaser personality. They, see, the perfectionist by nature doesn't really care what other people think. They will do what they want, and anorexics are quite selfish by nature. Not intentionally, but their drive to be, you know, not eat, and their drive to keep their weight down will mean that they will offend, they will do things that won't necessarily be kind to other people.
Right.
Whereas a bulimic personality is very much about pleasing other people. It's about making sure that if they are invited to a dinner party or if they go home to their parents' place for a meal or whatever, they will eat to please. But then they will go secretly to the bathroom and they will obviously make themselves ill. And a bulimic can often, their weight can fluctuate. They can be sometimes slightly overweight or slightly underweight, but they usually can keep their weight quite well. But the problem is that behind closed doors is that they can, I mean, eat vast amounts of food, and it's almost like they're in a trance state. They just can't stop themselves. They go into this complete altered state where the food frenzy starts.
Right. Just like one bite is too many and a thousand not enough.
Yes, correct.
Like
and
that.
It's like, you know, a lot of people say it's like this devil inside me comes out and there is absolutely nothing I can do to stop myself.
Well, yeah, and some people are like that about cheese.
Yeah.
You know, they bring home cheese and it's gone by the morning. So you know, I guess what you in your work you would be guiding the client to learn that they have a right to be free from those kinds of compulsions and that they have a right to live a healthy life and they have a right to reverse the inner critic that's in their mind that's driving them to do these behaviors?
Well, the inner critic is the backbone to all of this. So the psychology that I trained in California, Voice Dialogue, is a psychology that just completely blew my mind away because when I realized that their theory is that we're all made up of many parts or sub-personalities, like little mini people running around in our heads.
Right.
And the catalyst to any sense of overeating, drinking, whatever it is the inner critic part. Now, the inner critic voice is an unconscious voice. So originally it was created to protect us, to forewarn us, you know, in the old days when we were, you know, we were out in the forest and there were bears, etc., and it would give us a sense of what may happen. But there are no bears there anymore. But what we're doing is we're still interpreting fear and anxiety. And if you have a strong inner critic, it will forewarn you. It will be like your own personal psychic. And it will predict, say, for example, somebody who has a food issue, it will predict and say, well, you're going to go to a party tonight and everyone's going to say, oh, gosh, she's fat, he's fat. So you are fat, so you may as well just get fatter. And if you believe this negative propaganda to be true, it will become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Right.
And that vicious cycle occurs. So if you have a strong inner critic, it will, any hopes or dreams you have, any sense of a little beam of light that comes down sometimes you feel, I feel good about myself, is that around the corner is this inner critic saying, yeah, but for how long? So people don't realize consciously that unconsciously the inner critic has become the strongest voice. And what comes with the inner critic is anxiety, fear, and pure vulnerability. And how the unconscious mind works is it doesn't like you feeling unsafe. It's like, we don't like this. So it will scan your mind and say, the last time you were really, really down on yourself, what made you feel better? And if it was a block of cheese or if it was a whole tray of chocolates, if that's exactly what it will do without you actually consciously wanting to do it.
Right, right, because it's in your unconscious mind where you can't see it.
Yeah, I mean, it's always saying, I only like you to feel safe, so you give me the information that's going to support us to feel safe.
And right.
It doesn't matter if the habit's good or bad. It will still. That's what's amazing about the deeper part of the mind, is that it doesn't know right or wrong. It doesn't know that, you know, it doesn't know that chocolate, if you eat, you know, four bars of chocolate, it's going to make you fat. It just knows what you think is what makes you feel safe. So when you consciously say, right, okay, Monday's the day, I'm going to start my diet, that's it, da-da-da-da-da, all these grand plans, you might, you know, eat a bit too much over the weekend thinking, right, Monday's that day.
Mm-hmm.
And then all of a sudden, Monday comes around, you may be at work or at home, and something stressful happens. And you're thinking, oh, God, I really, really fancy some chocolate. And your inner critic says, oh, God, you're hopeless. It's already Monday. It's only Monday, and you can't succeed already. And so the anxiety starts to stir, the vulnerability starts to stir, and then all of a sudden, bang, that chocolate's in the mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And so that,
right.
That idea of wanting to start off the regime, and I call it a regime because it's usually very restrictive and very unkind to the person, is that it just, this spiraling of self-esteem just gets more and more, and the more the person wants to overeat when they really don't want to.
Right, right. And you were saying that a person who has put on weight is using that weight to make them feel emotionally safe.
Yeah, yeah. And people, you know, use weight for many reasons, fear of sexual intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
It could be that they have a fear of getting on in their lives. I hear often in my clinic and my workshops, people say, when I'm thin, I will get on with my life. So they use that as the barrier, whereas I'm saying, well, why don't you forget about getting thin? Why don't you do the things you want to do? And what will happen is if you do the things you really want to do in life, being overweight, you know what? The weight will drop away.
Right. It will, because you won't need it anymore.
Exactly, because you're doing things to make yourself feel better.
Yeah, yeah. And when a person reaches the point where they're tired of drinking too much at a party and waking up with a hangover, then, you know, what they used the alcohol for in the first place has really, they've outgrown its benefits for them. So, you know, I could see how coming to you, doing a session with you, going to your workshops, buying your books, listening to your CDs, could really help a person get to that next spot. And, you know, as we were saying about the synapses in the brain, science is proving that what you focus on is what you attract, and what you think about you bring about, because whatever you're thinking about most will create a brand new neural pathway in your brain that gets stronger and stronger and stronger every time you let the inner critic take over. And what I've experienced in your CDs and your books is that they're very good with helping us understand that the inner critic does not run the show, and to give us other better things to think about, to build new muscles and new neural pathways in our brain to create new and better behaviors that support our well-being instead of destroy it.
Mm-hmm. And that's what is amazing about the power of the mind is that, you know, even today, you know, we were talking about the art of suggestion. I mean, everybody knows Coca-Cola is not good for you.
Yes.
But we still drink it. Everybody
right.
knows cigarettes aren't good for you, but we still smoke. I mean, I don't smoke personally. But the point is that we have all of these habits going on in our mind, and it is literally physically being proven, as you said, that the mind will just keep creating these pathways until you redirect it, new pathways. And those new pathways are the pathways that I believe, obviously, with the work that I do, is helping that person to change their thinking. And when you change your thinking, your mind then realizes there is another path. There is actually, I've got another opportunity here. And then the inner critic, I mean, you know, it's a bit of a bummer for a lot of people. The bad news is that you can't get rid of the inner critic, because it does have some good points. You know, it can forewarn you when you have the balance and you can understand that the inner critic, you know, it has rules and regulations. It can forewarn you with the antennae of whatever.
Well, that's after you've trained it to behave itself.
Exactly. But if your inner critic running your life, is that you will be in a fairly permanent state of fear, whereas what I'm suggesting is when you tune out of the inner critic, and for you know, whether it's the slim part, whether it's the confident part, whether it's the whatever part, that optimistic, powerful, positive part, what they have shown is with the neurological pathways is that when you're thinking negative thoughts, which is your inner critic, you are creating pure stress chemicals, all the cortisol is coming out, and you want to run away. Whereas when you tune into that lovely, calm, confident part, is your unconscious mind will produce endorphins, those lovely, good feel factor sensations. And that is really what my work is about, is training your mind to be aware of the inner critic, that instead of it managing you, you're managing it.
In your new book, The Stress-Less Mind, Daily Survival Guide to Staying on Top of Your Life, is a really great book for these days and times. And, you know, what this book offers will surprise everybody who picks it up, because you might think you know what it's got in there. And I'm telling you, if this book existed of nothing, Georgia, except a mirror and the words, "You are beautiful," I believe that the benefits would be the same. Because really, this book is like that. It's like you're looking in a mirror in this book, because you're revealing to the person their greatness, and you're reminding them that that's who they really are. And you're doing it at a level that's in the unconscious mind, where the programming is getting in to a person's very fibers, and it's causing them to amplify their best parts instead of to believe what the inner critic is saying. So with regard to the stressless mind, what would you say to our listeners about the difference between that, the drinkless mind, and the weightless mind? What would be different about the stressless mind?
Well, the stressless mind is really the umbrella of the work that I do, and the reason why I wrote it was because everybody I treat and come on workshops, they obviously alcohol or food are the symptoms, so they're kind of fine-tuned. But underpinning it is a strong inner critic. And if you have a strong inner critic, you will be stressed. There is no way you can't be. And the stressless mind is really an anti-anxiety pill. It's an anti-negativity pill. It's something that you, because obviously the CD in the back is the self-hypnosis. 25 minutes is the recording. You are literally on this very deep cellular level training your mind to produce more endorphins. You're training your mind to actually move out of those negative states. And when you do this, the stressless mind is really about, on this deep level, obviously making these changes, but also being aware of the fact that there are so many triggers, stress triggers we have that are purely habitual. They're not even necessary, but we just keep rolling on the same old stress situations. So it's much more, the stressless mind is about people acknowledging that they have a powerful mind connected with the body that actually does know how to feel safe, but we need to train it. We need to show it how to do it. And this is what the book is about, is people taking stock, taking charge, and saying, well, you know what, actually, I don't have to feel this way anymore, and I have the tools, and that's what the book is about.
Wonderful. I believe that the self-hypnosis CD in the back of the book and each of your books is really a marvelous companion to the book itself. And individually, on their own, the book by itself without the CD would be extremely effective, and the CD without the book would be extremely effective. So the book and the CD together is like rocket fuel. It's really, really powerful, the combination. And, you know, I'm very excited about the stressless mind and all the whole body of work that you have going on. And you even have a sound sleep CD, a relaxation CD, and what are some others that you have that are available?
There is the Stop Smoking recording, which is fabulous. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would suggest anybody, you know, in terms of understanding the psychology of the work that I do, the Stress Less Mind will support, if you wanted to, you know, obviously the individual CDs. I mean, smoking, is once again, is another symptom.
Yes.
Well, interesting enough, it's you know, in regards to people who smoke too much, it is a habit. Mm-hmm. But most people are still emotional smokers. You know,
right.
It helps them cope. You know, it sort of helps them deal with... Well, people who are trying to lose weight, they might use smoking because, you know, they think that if I smoke rather than eat, then I'll stay slim. You know, there are all these psychological aspects to smoking. And then sleeping, confidence, relaxation, and I think that's it. Yeah. So, and the other, obviously the books have the CDs in the back too. The book that I'm just finishing off now, which is an e-book, is a book called Free to Be, and that's for people between the ages of 14 to 21. Because I'm treating more and more children and adolescents for all of these subjects, plus more. Yeah.
Right. Well, you know, it's you know, as technology grows and people have more access to it, they're becoming less social and isolating more, and you know, it's easier to get involved with things that really aren't good for a person when they isolate like that. And you know, the internet is a big culprit for, I mean, that could be an addiction all in itself for those ages you mentioned. And you know, there was a time where people those ages would be out playing sports and you know, going to social clubs, debate clubs, and you know, student council, and really excelling in all of these things, whereas those things don't seem to be quite as important as they once were in the school systems and in the family systems, because most families need to have both parents working one or two jobs each just to make ends meet. So the kids aren't getting the attention and the emotional availability from their parents that was once possible in the family system. So it's really great that you've created something to fill that need, because there certainly is a need there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm quite astounded when I hear children, how they speak and the expectations on them and what they're meant to be doing. And as you said, you know, they've got to have the best of everything. And it's extraordinary how times have changed so quickly. And I think that this is the problem, is that when a child has self-esteem issues, such as a strong inner critic, and this is, you know, we know that it's developed at a very early age, the inner critic, then when they are trying to be the best at, and for example, I was interviewed had an interview with a journalist in New York earlier in the year, and she was just saying that, you know, she's a lovely young girl, she was like 22, and she was saying that, so she was older than, obviously, she finished university at 22, she was saying, and she said that the pressure on her to be the best from her parents, to go to the right college, and all those expectations, I mean, she said to me, you know, she was a nervous wreck. And I think that the parents, because they're not connecting to their children, they're not listening, I'm not saying that's for everybody, of course, but there are certain families where I believe part of the problem is parents see their children as their self-esteem package. So if their children look good, if their children are successful, if their children do something like earn lots of money, then the parents kind of say, hey, all my friends are looking at me and saying, hey, what wonderful parents. But the children don't think that. The children are being so driven and being told they are expected to be perhaps something that they really genuinely weren't born to be. And they start to lose a sense of self.
Right.
And this is when problems occur, because if the parents are expecting the child to be a lawyer or a doctor, and they kind of want to be arty, or they want to be, you know, doing something completely not acceptable the parents want, the child will grow up feeling less than, and they will start to create anxieties and fears. And that's what I'm finding a lot with children, is they're saying, I don't want to go to this university. I don't want to go to this school. I want, you know, whatever. And the parents aren't listening to the children.
Right, right. Wow, it's just very, very complex. What exactly, I know you've given us a lot of clues about what makes your work different than other hypnotherapy, and I believe we don't really have in this country a female hypnotherapist who offers what you offer. So, you know, welcome to the United States, and I feel very excited for what's possible for you here. What makes your work different, Georgia? And it's georgiafoster.com if you want to pull up that website in case you've just joined us. It's www.georgiafoster.com. That's G-E-O-R-G-I-A. F is in Frank, O-S-T-E-R.com, georgiafoster.com. So the question was, what makes your work different than other approaches, Georgia?
Well, I mean, a lot of hypnotherapists will use a lot of visual aspects, and not that that's a problem, but I find for a lot of my clients is they're very stressed out, they're in a hurry to get better. So I kind of cut all that out, and I work very much with the dialogue. If I'm hypnotizing somebody, they come to my clinic or to a workshop, they're coming for one particular reason. They want change and they want it fast. They're very frustrated. They're very angry often at themselves because they can't understand why they can't break this habit. So I explain to them, you know, literally you are creating new pathways in your mind, real, true, tangible neurological pathways. And working, obviously, for those who don't mind the scientific aspect of it, when I introduce the psychology that I'm trained in and say, well, actually, I think this is what you're thinking, and they go, my God, Georgia, how do you know? And I say, well, I don't actually know, but what I do know, you have the symptom of what I call radio crazy, is negativity, the inner critic. So I work with their dialogue, and I practice with them, and I rehearse over and over again, literally drumming into their mind the feelings of the positive dialogue, connecting with the body and the endorphins, so that the whole system's working together. And then I train their mind to know the signs, know your own signs, so that when you feel that sense of fear or anxiety, and to be fair, we all experience it from time to time, obviously including myself, it's a matter of training your mind that you don't fall into it as deeply or as often. And so I work very much with all of the senses, as well as the physical body, so that the person, when they listen to the CD, when they come out, they actually start to mimic those statements. They start to feel the energy of the endorphins, and they start to walk their own talk about, you know, feeling good in themselves.
That's excellent, and really, like I said, what you think about, you bring about. And if you think you're a terrible person, you're going to bring about a terrible person. If you think you're a wonderful person, you're going to bring about a wonderful, loving person. So reprogramming your unconscious mind, really, I believe that the new frontier is the mind, and that science is now coming on board with that. You were speaking to me in a conversation about a chalk pill, a placebo, for antidepressants that actually worked more effectively than the antidepressant itself. Speak to that a little bit, Georgia,
yeah,
for our
sure.
listeners.
I had the privilege of working with a scientist called Dr. David Hamilton. We did a seminar earlier this year in April in London. And David, he was a fabulous speaker. He was talking about that when he used to work for one of the big pharmaceutical companies, a big international pharmaceutical company, and he was completely shocked about how much the pharmaceutical companies were hiding from the public, because when he studied the placebo effect, because he was one of the people who measured the results, is that there were people who were taking the chalk tablets, which was the placebo, and then obviously people were taking the antidepressants. And the people who were taking the chalk tablets were getting better results. And he said to himself, wow, I have to learn more about this. So he decided to quit the institution of pharmaceutical business, and he decided to explore what was really going on. So he studied the mind. He studied, and he's got so much evidence from many different sorts of programs from all over the world that the mind can learn anything if it's given enough time, as I say, and it's given the practice. And so when we did this talk together, David was just saying that the quickest, most effective way to change your thinking is with hypnosis stroke meditation, because they are the same thing. Mm-hmm. And what we do know is that when you go into a hypnotic state or a meditative state, is that you slow the brainwave activities down and your body slows down, the heart rate slows down, your breathing becomes deeper. And when you go into this altered state, is your mind can create anything, anything you want. And, he was just giving great examples of, in Switzerland, there was a woman who was in a fire and she had third-degree burns. And the doctor who went to where she was burnt, when she had just come out of the fire, and he asked her to imagine lying in a bath of ice, and he kept talking to her over and over again. Now, when you're in a shock state, you're actually in an altered state, because it's a way to control the pain.
Mm-hmm.
And he kept asking her, just keep imagining this bath of ice on your skin, cooling your skin down, cooling your entire body down. And she healed herself from that experience, and they were amazed, because other people who came out had burns and still have burns to this day. She's burn free. Now,
wow.
her mind did that.
Wow.
And through the art of suggestion, she did all of that herself, and that's incredible. And this is what the mind can do if you give it the chance, if you give it the space and the time. And, David was just backing up what we now know. He's an author with Hay House Publishing, and he's doing such great work, and it's just so wonderful to finally, after being a hypnotherapist for 15 years, to have scientists backing me up, which is brilliant.
Well, if he could cause that in a burn victim to be completely healed by walking her through that visualization process, then couldn't anybody out there who wants to be a world-renowned actor or a world-renowned writer, a world-renowned dancer, a world-renowned football player, you name it. Couldn't that same process bring them into their greatness state and have them believe it, which would create the biology to support it?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I would suggest as well that I do believe we're all on a journey, a path, and that if it's the right path, it will end up being that for that person. And, irrespective of imagining and believing, everything and anything is possible. But somebody, I often find that when somebody gets to the journey of where they want to be, such as a footballer or, if I treat somebody who's in the media or the celebrity world, is often when they get there, they realize it's not really what they want,
Yes.
So I often say to people, I think it's fantastic that you're inspired, that this is what you want to be and everything. But I do think that if it's not the path that's really been chosen for you or what's going to be the most effective for you as a person on this earth, then it might be something that you realize when you get thinking, actually, I've done that now. I want to move into a real space of where I really want to be. So that's kind of, I think, what the difference is.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, and to get someone who asks for you to help them with that journey, who happens to know that they have a lot of obstacles and blocks in the way of it, you're able to help them with those blocks, and perhaps in so doing help them to rediscover what their true purpose is, and it may not be what they came in to see you for.
Yes, absolutely. So, and that's what's amazing. What I do find, when you tune out of the inner critic, possibilities like ideas and creativity come out, and I find that in particular with the Drink Less Mind program, which has had a lot of press in the UK, is that the one thing we do know is that alcohol and drugs for that matter, but for this example, alcohol, when you drink alcohol, the inner critic goes somewhere else. So people get off on that feeling of being that confident person. It could be after a couple of drinks you become more chilled out, or perhaps you become more, you think, interesting, funny, or witty.
Or and, a singer.
Yeah. And then what happens is that when people use alcohol to run away from their inner critic, then that amazing creative person comes out, and they may be writing a book, whatever, or creating a poem, or painting something, and then they wake up in the morning, and their inner critic goes, "That was crap," and then they just think, "Oh, I'm not that artist, I'm terrible." So if that's their true desire, and I see that, this a lot in my work, is that people really do have these amazing talents that they're held back because of the inner critic. And so when you tune out of the inner critic, you train your mind to tune into that artistic, creative person that you were really born to be, amazing things happen. And that is when I believe the true spirit of the person comes out.
And the playfulness and the childlike beauty
of
that person. And because it's really the inner child that gets repressed and shamed and is afraid to come out to play, and the alcohol inspires the inner child to come out and express itself, and then later shames it for that very thing the next morning when the person wakes up with a hangover, right?
Yeah, and then it's like this radio crazy again for the day. And that's when I always say to people, you know, I believe that, you know, the person who wakes up in the morning at 9 o'clock with a bit of a hangover, feeling a bit anxious, maybe got the booze blues a little bit, the inner critic's having a fantastic field day with them saying, my God, what did you say last night? What happened last night? My God, who's sleeping next to you? Whatever it is. And then the anxiety starts to stir, and that person may then think, oh God, it's 9 o'clock, I really need a drink. Now, you know, if you look on any of the websites about measuring are you an alcoholic or not, they'll say if you feel like a drink at 9 o'clock in the morning, you're an alcoholic. I disagree with that absolutely. What I believe is the reason you want to drink at 9 o'clock in the morning is simply because your inner critic is going haywire, and your mind has trained itself to think about alcohol as the way to fix it. So the beauty of the work that I do is when you tune out, you train your mind to tune out of the inner critic. You may have, you know, a couple of drinks the night before, whatever. Wake up in the morning and you don't have that anxiety. You wake up thinking, you know, I had a couple of drinks last night, I had a really lovely evening, I'm going to get on with my day now. And that's the difference. That's what's really great about it. That I
feel good about it, yeah.
Yeah, that people who come to see me in the workshop, and I get so many emails from people saying to me, I can't believe I've been going to AA for years, or, you know, I've been trying to abstain but without success, and, you know, whatever. And now I realize it was my thinking that was causing my drinking. And
that
is what it's about. Yeah.
Very well said. And I want to ask before we're at the end of our Spiritual Hollywood Hour, Georgia, for all of our listeners out there who might be very cynical about hypnosis, is it possible to hypnotize every person?
Yes, absolutely.
Why is that?
Well, all hypnosis is self-hypnosis. I'm only facilitating, whether it's guiding you on the recording or in a workshop. I mean, what is lovely about hypnosis is that it's the stage just before you go to sleep at night. So if people often say to me, oh, Georgia, I couldn't possibly be hypnotized, I say, well, you must be a very tired person because you cannot go to sleep unless you go to the hypnotic state. It's impossible. And then obviously when you come out of the sleep state, we also know that about every 7 minutes you go into a natural hypnotic state, because the conscious mind is not where the information is stored. It's your unconscious mind. So around about every 7 minutes, your mind will have to back up the software, so to speak, by what you've just, you know, been experiencing for 7 minutes.
Well, would that explain why people look like they're watching a movie every so often in their mind?
Yeah, exactly. You could be driving a car and you think, how did I get here?
Right, you get velocitized.
And that's
kind of scary, especially if you're behind the wheel. But, you know, it's so often, and I do it myself, I'll be in the middle of something and then catch myself watching a movie in my head and, you know, working something out in my head, and then I'll go, why was I thinking of that? And then I trace it back and I find out what caused me to think about that thing, and then next thing I know, I'm having like a 7 or 10 minute movie I'm watching, and my husband will catch me. He'll say, well, what movie are you watching? And I'll go, I was watching a movie, wasn't I? And then I'll look at what it was I was looking at, and more often than not, it's something critical about myself. And then at least I'm catching myself in the act, and then I do my best to say, okay, that wasn't real, it was just a movie.
Yeah, exactly, and that's what's great about the reality of the truth, is it's not real.
Right.
Absolutely. And in those moments, and I always, you know, I say to people that imagine that when you're in that daydream state, you're imagining good things, and that's what's possible too. You know.
Right. And to visualize what you do want instead of revisit The Hauntings of the Inner Critic. That's a muscle that needs to be worked. And if you buy a membership to a gym and you don't go, you're not going to get any results. So if you want these things for yourself and you don't do the work required to strengthen those muscles, then you're not going to get any results. With Georgia's books and companion CDs, go to her website, www.georgiafoster.com, GEORGIAFOSTER.com. Check out what's available for you there, and you don't even have to get in your car and drive to any office. You get this book, you have a CD player. I don't know too many people who don't have them. I think even now homeless people have CD players and cell phones. So, you know, a CD player is easy to have, and you put the CD on after you, you know, read a few chapters of the book, you listen, you use the book as a companion, use the CD as a companion, and you will find yourself feeling better so fast. Like Georgia says, it is a process, and it's really delicious when you find something that actually helps, that costs you very little time, energy, and resources, and it's a wonderful way to provide self-care for yourself, and that is the building blocks to self-love, and self-love is the answer to all the inner critics. It will quiet the inner critic and have it only serving you instead of you serving it. Is that not correct, Georgia?
Yes, and I think it's important, that, as what you've just said, to back that up with when you feel good about yourself, possibilities, amazing things happen. When you're in a fearful state, nothing can get in because you don't believe it to be true. And this is what's so great about working with this deep part of your mind. It doesn't know, as I said, what's good or bad, but if you train it to feel good rather than bad, you will calm down, you'll see opportunities, you'll attract great things into your life because you know you have the right to experience them. And that's what is so important.
Right, and your approach, I don't know if it's a voice dialogue approach or if it's just the way you speak. And I will say that to hear in the CDs that you have a right to be to wake up without a hangover. You have a right to feel good about yourself. You have a right not to be stressed out. You have a right to live fully and have peace in your life. And a lot of people don't go around knowing they have a right to have peace in their life. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to hear that statement, it makes a light bulb go off in your head. And it's like, wow, I never heard it that way before. You know, you can hear 100 different messengers say the same message and never really get that message until someone says it in just the right way to trigger your memory of what you already know to be true about yourself. Mm-hmm. And I believe that that's what you're very gifted at, Georgia. I've studied a lot of forms of personal development and self-help and personal growth, and your CDs and books and what you offer and your approach, the Foster Method, really something different, really something special, really worth exploring, and really accessible. I mean, you have a right to get these tools and use them, I will say. And I believe your books are all available on Amazon.com. Is that right, Georgia?
Yeah, if people can buy direct from the website, that's absolutely fine. The other option, obviously, as well, is that the books are all on e-book format, too. So if you wanted to spend a little bit less money, of course, and you have facilities, your computer, you can download the book and also the MP3 that comes with it. So either or, if you prefer a hard book with a CD, which I think most people do, but if you are a bit of a techno person and you're happy to download it, you can get it within a second.
Right, that's wonderful. And, you know, we all like things to happen really fast.
Well, when you have a strong inner critic, you know, I think it's sort of like an emergency surgery situation sometimes.
Triage.
So, yeah. You know, yeah, absolutely.
You're looking for triage and an instant, you know, help me feel better. And you do offer that. And you also inspire in people to begin their process for a lifetime of personal growth. I mean, these books aren't a Band-Aid. They are really substantial in causing true healing and wholeness in a person because they just make good sense. They just do. And we're coming up on the last 60 seconds of a Spiritual Hollywood Hour. And, Georgia, I'd like to, this time, invite you to say whatever's on your heart and whatever you think that the listeners out there would like to hear from you.
Sure. Well, you know, I think everybody has the opportunity to change your thinking. and to understand and respect that what you may be thinking at the moment isn't the truth if it's negative. You just need to trust. You need to take the time out to create the space in your mind, and anything is possible.
Absolutely. And many things that are wonderful beyond our imagination are probable once we get out of our own way. And I just want to take this time to say thank you, Georgia, for all the all the great work that you're doing, and for providing that for our planet during this wonderful time to be alive. And I want to thank our listeners for tuning in this week. Just know that next week we have another guest called Hollis Durand, who is a medium who works with John Edwards, so that will be an interesting show as well. And again, Georgia, thank you for sharing your gifts with us this evening. And I'm very pleased about all that's coming for you, and wish you the best of luck in the United States for your PR campaign, because there's a place for you here and a calling for you here, and you're filling it. So congratulations on that. And I just want to say good night, everybody, and thanks again for joining us. And remember, the last six letters of attraction are action, so get busy and create the life that you came here to live. Good night.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.